This is a Glass Box Media podcast.
Lauren.
Mike.
So we host a podcast for Wired called Gadget Lab.
We do.
We do.
Yes, that is correct.
Tell the good people some more about it.
Well, I think the good people should definitely tune in every week because they get to hear me roasting you.
Hey, now.
All right. No, really, what Gadget Lab is Mike and I tackling the biggest questions in the world of technology. I like to think of it as the best of Wired's journalism, but in audio form. We cover the big news of the week in techland, but we also offer our expert analyses and opinions on all things consumer tech, whether that's mobile apps, hardware, startups, cryptocurrency. Mike, what's been a recent highlight episode for you?
We did a deep dive on the group behind the massive Okta hack. Mm-hmm. We also had a great conversation about Web3 and the metaverse. What stands out for you?
Never metaverse you didn't like. I really enjoyed our recent podcast about Peloton. And recently, the legendary tech journalist Kara Swisher joined us to talk all about Elon Musk and the future of Twitter. So I guess we should tell people how they can listen to our pod.
We release a new episode of Gadget Lab every week, and you can listen and follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you pod.
Today on Around the Coin, I interview Sam and Dov Falik of Blockbar. We talk about what Blockbar is, the first global direct-to-consumer NFT platform for wine and spirits, what their strategy is, which is partnering with the brands to create NFT drops or minted NFTs for limited version premium and super premium, so high-end, very unique wine and spirits that these brands are making. It's a really exciting company because they are allowing people to trade aftermarket the bottles without actually trading the bottles using NFTs. They allow the brands to introduce new concepts to consumers direct, and they facilitate the actual transactions at Blockbar. They have a location, a warehouse in Singapore. We talked about why they chose Singapore and how they manage their operations. I learned a ton from this conversation, and I hope you do as well. Here is Sam and Dov Falik. Sweet. So we got Sam and Dov on. You guys are running a really cool startup called Blockbar. Before I try to describe it, maybe I'll point to Sam first. You want to give me a description of what the company does and what it, where you were when you came up with the concept, how you knew this was something you wanted to spend your life doing?
Yeah, for sure. I actually came up with so Dov and I are first cousins. That's why we have the same last name, just in case anyone was wondering. But I was actually visiting Dov in Panama because Dov and his family are primarily based in Panama. We were sitting on his beach house, and I was trying to explain to Dov and his dad NFTs, this new craze that was kind of coming around, something that was, you know, on every headline. And at the time, I was trying to explain it, and I felt silly trying to explain it just because I didn't really know enough about it. So, you know, I obviously, as they were poking holes in what NFTs do and what NFTs are, I didn't really have the answers. But we kind of looked at NBA Top Shot, and that was kind of very relatable to Dov and his dad. Then, you know, we came home, Dov and I are in a group chat with two of our other cousins. We were just kind of, you know, talking about the world of NFTs, what we think is going to come of it, what's going to happen. And then from the experience that I had with Dov's dad, we kind of realized that there is kind of this barrier for entry for NFTs, which I'm sure many people know. You know, whenever you buy your first NFT, it's always a hurdle. But primarily what we our initial thesis of the company was, you know, what if rather than selling NFTs from artists and on websites that people don't really know, what if we sell it directly from luxury brands? Dov and I come from a background in the duty-free industry. Our family owns Duty Free Americas. So like NBA Top Shot comes directly from the NBA, that's kind of why people get it so quickly. We said, you know, what if we sell NFTs directly from some of the brands that we know? And we started, you know, kicking the can with ideas. We mocked up a bottle of fragrance. We mocked up a beautiful haute couture dress. And then Dov works primarily in the wine and spirits category in Duty Free Americas. I'll let him tell you a little bit more. But then again, you know, we were still kind of trying to figure out exactly what to do in the world of fragrances. You know, we didn't really think that it was as collectible as it should be. You know, it's not really a big thing for people. So we said, you know, what if we could sell NFTs directly from luxury brands? And what if we're solving an actual problem rather than, you know, just using it as kind of a marketing campaign? And then that's when Dove kind of opened my eyes into all of the barriers of entry in the world of wine and spirits too. So when you look at the wine and spirits industry, just to name a few issues, there's issues around access, meaning if you want a super premium bottle of wine or spirits, it's pretty difficult to actually get the proper bottle. Then there's issues with storing it, shipping it, reselling it. And ultimately, at any point, if you do want to resell it, you are going to have an issue of proving authenticity. So Dove and I drew a lot of inspiration from Uniswap, the Unisoc model. We thought it was very cool. So that's kind of when everything started coming together, where we said, why don't we create a platform where consumers buy NFTs directly from luxury brands? Each NFT is going to correspond to an actual bottle of spirits or wine. We'll store it for consumers. And then consumers with the NFT will have the ability to resell it on the platform, resell it on any Ethereum-based platform, gift it to anybody across the entire world, start a collection, or at any point they can exchange the digital version for the physical version. So basically it proves authenticity up until the point of consumption. Because what we do is we basically allow the bottle to transfer an infinite number of times without the physical bottle ever having to leave the facility.
I dig that. I like that a lot. Dov, do you want to add on to that? Anything?
Yeah, no, just, I mean, I think Sam explained it really well. So, I mean, again, Sam was really explaining how NFTs work. And then as we're looking at the issues that you have in the wine and spirits world, as Sam said, there's authenticity, there's access, all that type of stuff. But really, I think one of the issues is that it's also undervalued. There is a world of collecting, but it's very limited to a certain demographic and very, you know, you have to be in that world that knows how, you know, that knows what's going on. It's, you know, closed Facebook groups, kind of, you know, when you do want to sell something, it's very hard to do that. So understanding the limitations of the wine and spirits world is really what, you know, married these two together for us, and kind of felt like a perfect fit. And then, you know, from there is when we went, you know, and as Sam said, we're in the wine and spirits business for a long time, you know, from my family's business with Duty Free Americas, we went to the brands and ran through all the obstacles that they have and we have as retailers, as collectors, as brand owners, and showed how NFTs can really create a solution for this. And that's really how we got into it. And we spoke to the brands. I think it made sense for everyone. And that's where this came about.
And you guys are young guys. It sounds like Duty Free Americas is a company that's been around. I've never heard of Duty Free Americas. Can you give me a sense for the scale of it, Dov? Like how many, is it a retail shop? Or?
So we have around 200, over 220 duty free locations around the world, primarily focused in the Americas. So basically, when you go to an airport or a border crossing in the U.S., you know, between the U.S. and Canada, U.S. Mexico, different airports around the world, you have the opportunity to buy products, as in liquor, duty free. So you buy it without paying, you know, local taxes, just because you're leaving the country. What happens a lot of duty free is you just have a very captive audience, and because of that, because, you know, you have millions of passengers going through very, very small locations. So, you know, for example, in Atlanta Airport, there's 100 million people that go through that airport. Now, not everybody's traveling internationally, but you have, you know, it's one of the biggest airports in the world, and you have a massive captive audience. So brands like to put their most expensive and their best products out there in the duty free world. So we really get a lot of these customers that we already interact with for many years, and they are, you know, they're coming through our shops and they're buying very expensive whiskeys, and they have to travel with it, you know, carrying that burden, knowing that they can break. Yes, they have a tax, you know, there's a tax incentive to do that, but at the end of the day, that bottle can break. You have to take it with you if you're coming back to the U.S. You have to take it, you know, there and back. You might incur duties when you come back, and then, you know, you get into all the problems that we address with Blockware. So yeah, Duty Free Americas is a family run business. Been operating since for many years with us since 2001, we operate mostly in the Americas.
Yeah, my experience with this is that it seems like the airports just funnel you through that. Like you oftentimes are walking through the duty free shop just to get to the terminal. How does that work behind the scenes? Is there a contract between airports? Because it seems often like there's just one duty-free shop, yeah. And it's just called duty-free. It's not like, you know, yeah, so it's a very kind of no label brand.
So usually they are labeled, but a lot of the brands are very similar to duty-free. So, you know, you have
right.
Duty-free Americas, duty-free shoppers, duty-free. So they're all very similar name. But basically, yes, the airport issues a bid. They issue an RFP, then, you know, different retailers will come and offer different, you know, how much money they're willing to pay for that. And then usually it's a shared revenue model with the airport. So you know, they're taking a percentage of sales. So that the airport has a big interest in making sure that, there's more sales going through there, they want more airlines coming to the airport because that creates a lot of business for them. So the airport really manages that, and then usually it's a single operator. There's different airports in different ways. You know, JFK, just because there's so many different terminals, each terminal could be a different operator. But again, it's I would say there's in the U.S. there's different operators that operate in a different scale.
Yeah, it makes sense. Sam, how did you kick this off? So you have this concept. To me, it makes sense. I would imagine that other people can think about this in a similar way, where you're solving the problems of storage, you're solving the problems of liquidity, you're having a centralized marketplace where people can exchange, and then you're solving the problem of payment facilitation. Like if I actually want to sell you a bottle of wine that is stored, even if it's stored centrally in some repository, I have to pay you, you know, an eBay acquired PayPal to be able to do that. Crypto solves that problem. So this feel like between the storage, the market liquidity, and the payment transactions, there's three major components of this. Is there other things that you feel are subtle nuances to the business that you might only recognize by getting into it and doing? Like, are people who buy these things have no intention to ever drink them, or vice versa? Do people often want to recall the wines and have them for dinner at some point?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I thought ultimately ended up being more difficult than we anticipated in the beginning, and again, just because we're kind of playing in between a balance of, you know, liquor connoisseurs, which are usually an older demographic, and NFT heads, which are usually a younger demographic. And we're offering a product for both. So we kind of wanted each age cohort to kind of understand what's happening. So initially, when we were doing it, you know, we said, we're going to accept fiat. And we do accept fiat, but we thought, I don't know about you though, but I thought it was going to be much easier to implement fiat than it actually was. Meaning, you know, there's credit card, there's wire transfer, there's the primary sale. Everything still has to be recorded on the blockchain. So how exactly does that happen? Then there's also the secondary sale. You know, what if one person is selling in ETH and the other person is buying in fiat and vice versa? So it is very nuanced. And there's a ton of, you know, regulatory components that we definitely didn't think of in the beginning. In terms of the actual market of people who are purchasing the assets, initially when we were setting it up, we kind of split up into a few different groups. Number one is the traditional liquor collector, you know, someone who understands the burdens of collecting premium spirits and wine. You know, they're running out of space in their cellar, or they're moving from point A to point B, and they realize that logistically it's not really feasible, even though it's a great hobby. Number two is, you know, crypto skeptics, people who hear about crypto, they want to get involved in crypto, but are still skeptical and think that it's going to go down. So this is a way for them to invest, to get exposure into the crypto world, but still have a hard asset backing it. And then there's also people who are just looking to invest. And again, I have to give the caveat that this is not financial advice, but premium wines and spirits is traditionally a very good investment. Urge everyone to do their own research. But like Dov was saying, it's actually very difficult to crack into that world. So this is an easy way for people who are looking to diversify their portfolio, both in the traditional markets and in the crypto markets. This is kind of something that hits two birds with one stone.
Mm. Yeah, I would just add to that I think if you look at one of the things that people don't see in this world of wine and spirits is that, as you mentioned, of buying and selling through eBay or PayPal, whatever that is, legally, you're not allowed to be a reseller of wine and spirits. So it's one of the only collections that we could think of that you as an individual are not allowed to sell. So to sell wine and spirits, you have to have a liquor license. Now, are there ways around that where you go through an auction house and stuff like that? Yes. But at the end of the day, you know, you can buy an expensive watch and you can resell it anywhere. You could buy, you know, shoes that are collectibles and resell them. You could buy NFTs, you could buy art, and you could resell, you know, all these collectibles in the world you're allowed to resell. When it comes to wine and spirits, you're kind of stuck with your avenues and ways to sell. And that's really where we saw that e-commerce in liquor, because again, we deal in this world a lot. It's very difficult to scale e-commerce out of your boundary. So, you know, if you're in the US, you have a huge market to grow from, but again, you're in the US. We're in areas in Latin America where we simply can't scale larger than the country we're in just because of the regulatory issues. So when you start getting into trading NFTs, that's really where you can start really trading and buying and selling, because you're technically you're buying and selling the digital asset. So in the world of today of buying and selling wine and spirits, you have very few options. What this really does is it opens up this whole world and democratizes it to the whole world. So everybody, you know, anybody can become an individual collector and reseller, because again, you're buying NFTs and you're selling NFTs. So that's, I think that's one of the things, one of the nuances that we found, that can really open this up to the whole world that most people don't have access to.
Yeah. And part of the reason that I think wine and spirits was so attractive to us, number one, like Dove was saying, it's one of the only collectibles that you can own, but you can't resell yourself. Number two, it's very difficult to store it yourself. You know, a lot of people buy a bottle of wine, and they say they're going to drink it when, you know, their kid graduates college. But, you know, after 20 something years of storing that bottle of wine in direct sunlight and then moving from, you know, New York to Miami, ultimately when you're drinking that, you're essentially drinking vinegar. You know that wine wasn't stored properly, even though it was for a great occasion. And then also, I'm careful saying this, but it's pretty much impossible to authenticate a bottle of premium wine and spirits. You know, earlier today, I was talking to someone and he was like, why don't I just go to a liquor store, buy a bottle, and then sell it at auction? I was like, you can, but ultimately the risk that you're running is that it's kind of impossible for you to prove that it's authentic, because you can authenticate the bottle and the label. But the most common way to counterfeit a bottle of wine or spirits, I don't know if anyone has seen sour grapes, is you get the real bottle, you get the real label, you get the real letter of authenticity, you somehow drain out the liquid through a needle or some other mechanism, and then you refill it with some other liquid. Then when you go to wherever you're reselling it, you're selling the real bottle, the real label, the real letter of authenticity with the fake liquid inside. And the consumer who's buying it has no idea. Likely, they don't know what it's supposed to taste like, so they have nothing to compare it to. Or even if it is authentic, they're running the risk that the person who owned it prior to them just mismanaged it and didn't store it properly. So it could be that the bottle is actually authentic, but the liquid has gone bad. So I think that that's kind of why we said, you know, yes, our model works with fashion. Our model works with watches. Our model works with a lot of different industries, just because everyone wants to own cool stuff, but there's not really a need to store it in your house anymore. But part of the reason why it works specifically with wine and spirits is because of the everyday hurdles that people who collect already know it. And then there's other people who just don't have access to it. And then by the time you find out about all this, it's usually a little bit too late.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to me, it feels like Dov's point alone proves the case that you guys just have a really unique application. And honestly, I'm like, why ever? I mean, don't go outside spirits. It's like The world is big enough here where just stay in this lane. Just the pure legal entanglement of not being able to buy and sell wines privately, and that makes it so different than everything else that exists. That I'm sure that every other player in the space that wants to sell watches or shoes or things, they're going to be really apprehensive about getting into this space. And then the fact that you have all of these people who are just passionate just about trading wines and spirits, it's like it's its own world. It doesn't seem by analogy like Amazon starting with books and then moving to so on and so forth.
I agree, yeah.
Does it legally work where you as the company will own all the bottles and then you're allowing people to trade their certificates, the NFTs, and then at the end of the day, somebody makes a claim to own that bottle and wants it shipped to them, so you... I guess how does the transaction of ownership work? Say, right, I buy the bottle on the site, I own the NFT, I trade it a bunch of times, Joe in Iowa owns it, and he wants to drink it. How does the transfer ownership work there?
So first of all, every NFT that we mint and every product on our site is sold in partnership directly with the brands, which is how we really solve the issue for authenticity or get as close to it as we can.
Oh, okay.
So every product on our website is done in partnership with the brands. Then what we do is we mint the NFT to the brand's wallet. So for example, we had an RBEG drop today. If you were to check on Etherscan, the wallet, the first wallet that it transacted with, it'll be, I think it's RBEG whiskey.eth, so that you have some assurance that it comes directly from the brand. Then from a legal standpoint, and this is just, you know, how we had to do it, when you buy the NFT, and we make this clear on every transaction that we have, each NFT represents proof of ownership, proof of authenticity, verification of ownership, and the right to have the corresponding asset delivered. Now, we can't guarantee delivery just because, you know, ultimately, when you do go to redeem the product, you're going to have to put in your name, your address, your ID. And if someone bought the NFT but is underage within their local jurisdiction to import it, we can't, you know, guarantee delivery. Then also number two, if someone is trying to import it into a region where they're not allowed to import alcohol, for example, you know, Saudi Arabia or the state of New York, where you're not allowed to import spirits, then we run into that same issue as well. So basically what we word it as is it's the ability to apply for redemption, but redemption is guaranteed as long as you're in full compliance of the law. So basically you're trading the proof of authenticity. And then ultimately when you go on the BlockBar interface, you redeem the bottle. So you burn the NFT and redeem the physical product. And then it's shipped.
And your other option is always to come pick up the bottle in our facility or pick up in any of our duty-free locations. So, you know, you do have that option. If, you know, if you're in an area where you just can't be shipped to, you can always come pick it up.
Yeah, and I think that's perfectly fine. I can't imagine why it would matter. I mean, you can't expect people to, I mean, they're on some random island in outside Africa and they're like, well, I want you to ship me this bottle. It's like, no, you have to be within certain parameters, certain age, location. Like there's got to be constraints. And I also think that it makes a lot of sense that people can buy the ownership of it, right? Say somebody is allergic to alcohol, they hate drinking, but they're a trader and they're like, this is a good, let me get into this segment. Let me analyze the data, see the trends, make some educated bets in the space, and then buy the rights to them, sell them. Like this person never has any desire to cash in on that drink. But there's no reason they can't be a player in the space and provide liquidity and efficiency of the market.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that the point that Sam mentioned is really important to us. We only work directly with the brands. So technically what we could have done and would have made this process much easier and simpler was take the stock that we have from duty free. You know, we get a lot of exclusive products, put those on the site and say, okay, here are the products that are available. But then again, how do you prove that that's authentic? Yeah. Can you trust duty free Americas? Probably.
You run into the same problem, really.
Yeah, you're going to run into all the same problems over and over again. So what we said is the real value is when it comes directly from the brands. Even more so, everything that we drop, or 99% of what we drop, is always exclusive to us, to BlockBar. So you'll never find that in a local liquor store. So anything we drop, you just won't find in a local liquor store. So that also gives the appreciation value a little bit more of an upside, because if it's exclusive and you can't find it anywhere else, this won't be produced again. So there's many different examples of what we've dropped that you just won't find again. And that's where I think we provide real value versus just taking stock that you can, because if we could just put up a bottle of Johnny Walker Black that we have in our store, yeah. What's the point? There's no point in collecting that. It's not a collectible item. There's no point in actually doing any of this. And so that's really why we said, you know, let's go directly to the brands. The brands drop the product. You are interacting with the brands, which also gives you a whole new world to interact with, because we haven't even touched on what the brand offers from this. So you have, you know, direct access to the brands when it comes to communication, private dinners, events, all these different things that the brands will start providing that you just don't get from a normal, you know, liquor interaction. Even if you're a collector, a lot of times they don't know who you are. Because think about what happens if you're a collector, you buy it from, you know, somebody bought it, then they sold it to someone else or sold it to someone else. Eventually you're the final owner. You're the actual one who's going to drink this product. The brand has no idea who you are. And, you know, they have no way to interact with you. But here, you know, through proof of ownership, you through NFTs, you could obviously see who the owner is at the end of the day, and how, and they can reach out to you and offer you different types of, you know, incentives of what, you know, how to become more of a collector with them, and all different types of things. So that's one of, you know, that's one of the utilities that I think that there will be very strong in our community.
Well, I have two questions for you, Dov. The first one, is it true that everything that, is it true that brands are making drinks specifically to sell lines on Block Bar, where, you know, there's 300 bottles and they just don't make, can they spin up new drinks like that? I mean, I would imagine they have big production lines or.
So they have big production lines, but then they also have certain things that are very exclusive that a lot of times, look, they're very exclusive and they just either, they're very expensive to put them out for sale because, you know, where do they allocate these bottles to? So for example, the Ardbeg drop that we just had, there were a couple, I think there were a couple barrels that were put underground. There was an experiment that Ardbeg did a few, I think 10 years ago. They put them under, it was like seven years ago. They put these barrels underground to see what happens and how these whiskeys age when they're underground. That experiment will only be seen with those two barrels that, you know, that will be taken out of the ground and now bottled. So that's something that they launch with us exclusively. Something else is, for example, there's a very old bourbon that we launched that they put six bottles in 6 liter bottles. So they only made five of these 6 liter bottles that you can never find again. It's whiskey that's aged since 1982. So I think when it comes to wine and spirits, again, I think that what makes it different from any other collectible is, and this is why I think it's just undervalued, is most of these things have been aged for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, you know, depending on what we're dropping. They're aged for so long. There's only a certain amount of liquid that you can get from there. So if you know how the aging process works, there's a 2% evaporation approximately that goes into every year. It evaporates 2%. So when they bottle these products, you know, somebody had to lay down the whiskey 30, 40 years ago. They then start trying it and decide when the perfect time it is to bottle it. And then they put it into different casks. You know, there's a whole science of how they do these things. But there's only a limited amount of products that are going to be out there that are aged so many years. And can they do this again? Yes. In 30 years, they'll hopefully launch another 30-year-old. You know, so I just think that the wine and spirits world is just undervalued because of the time and effort that goes into it. And frankly, I think, you know, even the Johnnie Walker Black, what we just spoke about, is a 12-year-old whiskey that's been aged 12 years old in barrels. You don't get a lot of things that you can buy that are 12 years old. So I think a lot of thought and process and engineering goes into these things that then I think the reason that they're not collected more is just because collecting is hard. You know, how do you restore it? How do you authenticate it? How do you interact with it? You can't sell it. So, you know, it just makes the whole process very difficult for someone. So, you know, and then you have the problem with insurance that, you know, you're scared of something going wrong. So why would you get into this? So that's what, those are the problems that we try to solve, to really make it more investable, collectible. And then ultimately, you know, what we say in the brand says is all of this product is to enjoy and to drink and to, but a lot of times it's for a special occasion, and it's that special occasion. You just don't want to have to take care of it and think about it the whole time until that special occasion comes. So that's really why we think it's the proposition is unique.
And previous to this, the brands would they sell these like small runs? Would they sell them to auction shops?
Yeah. So they have different ways of selling them. They have auction shops. A lot of it goes to duty free because, you know, you have that type of customer. So, but what happens is you just don't know where that customer is coming from. So say they have, you know, on a very high aged Scotch, you'll only get probably from a barrel, say, depending on what you're getting, but let's say 150 to 200 bottles. When you do get that, where do you put that? Do you put it in, you know, because you're going to start marketing and starting, you know, you have to start getting that to customers. Do you start putting that in Asia? Do you put it in the Americas? You want as much exposure as possible. So you start targeting different markets, and you might get it right, you might get it wrong, but, you know, you kind of get stuck in where you put those products because, you know, and usually, it's the same type of buyers that are buying this all the time. It's the typical collectors that are buying these, and they're the only ones that know how to store and collect and then resell to different buyers and know how to do that. So it's a very small, tight-knit world that are collecting and have the opportunity to do this. But again, you know, it's very difficult to scale it around the world, and that's what we try to do, to just democratize it and open it up for anybody that's interested in it. They do have their collections. We're not the only ones to get high end products. There's others that do it. But I think just the way to collect and the way to invest in it is what we're trying to change.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like if I'm a brand, what you just described sounds like a shitload of work, where I'm contacting all these airports and I'm setting up marketing deals. And I got sales guys on the phone. If I could just come and say, okay, we're not even going to touch the actual goods. We're just going to launch an NFT. Let this run. I could see, Sam, one day you build a virtual reality room where I throw the headphones on the goggles on, and now I'm looking at all the different kind of, like the Matrix, right? It's like, pull me out the wines or pull me out the vodkas, whatever. And I see all the different, okay, there's 78 bottles of this, and it's all digital, but it allows me to see it, touch it, feel it, the branding's there, and then I can buy it, trade it. You can get into analytics. I could see you guys building a whole analytics platform that shows like trends over time and attracting people who are really about trading these things and drive up liquidity in the market. Does seem like, yeah, huge idea. I mean, the fact that it's better for brands, better for individual consumers, and then also opens up the market for traders is huge. The only people who don't win, and I wouldn't even say they lose, are the duty-free shops. Like, if I'm a duty-free shop, I'm not excited about this. I'm probably not worried about it because my business is still going to have all these people coming through. But, and I imagine the vast majority of these duty-free shops, their business is in the $45 to $70 bottle. You know, people aren't going to the airport to buy rare bottles of Johnny Walker or something.
Yeah. I think that, first of all, a lot of the time this product ends up going to just private clients. So if they have a really exclusive, you know, barrel that was bottled, let's say, you know, 1967, that happened to be a great year, a great vintage, whatever it is, whether you're talking about wine or whiskey, that a lot of times, if it's so rare and they can't really allocate that product, they usually just go to their private clients. But yeah, I completely agree with you. First of all, on your point of, you know, virtual reality and metrics, it really is about creating an immersive experience for consumers and the brand. Because we do view ourselves as providing a direct channel of communication from the brand to the consumer. But also the next part you said is actually very true, which is, we don't believe that our business really cannibalizes any of the brand's existing businesses. We're not really going after the auction houses. We're not going after the duty-free shops. Just what we're really trying to do is expand the piece of the pie, not really take a piece of someone else's pie. Just because we do feel like we're attracting a much younger demographic. We're removing the barrier of entry where a lot more people could come in, collect, and invest. You know, a great example was our first drop of Glenfiddich. It was 15 bottles of $18,000, $18,000 of Glenfiddich. I think it was a 46-year-old, sold out in 4 seconds. We polled all of the people who bought it. No one who purchased one had ever bought a bottle of whiskey or wine over $150 before.
Wow.
And then we followed up with them. Yeah, sorry.
I was going to ask, how many do you think, I don't know if you asked them this, how many do you think will actually drink it versus they bought it anticipating to sell it?
I don't think many of these will specifically drink it, but you never know. But also another part that I thought was funny is we had a lot of inquiries after from a lot of the people who bought the product saying, you know, can I get merch from the brand? And then they were like, you know, can you tell the brand that every time I go out now, I only drink Glenfiddich, that's my drink. And when you ask some of these people, it's like, they never cared before. You know, they would go to the bar and order a vodka soda, you know, tequila on the rocks, whatever it was. But now they're looking for specific brands just because they had such a great interaction with the brand the first time. So again, we feel like we are really, you know, expanding the demographic of people and who are learning about this industry. And also the immersive experience is very important. We did a drop with Penfolds Wine where one of the experiences was a private wine tasting class with Peter Gago, the winemaker, which, you know, that's pretty cool. If I'm someone like myself, I've never had a private wine tasting class from, you know, a very well-respected wine company. You know, in this one, it gave the chance for people who spent a couple $100 to, you know, get that access. And also the price point, you nailed it right on the head, where we're not looking to sell $20 to $70 bottles for, you know, $1,000. We're really looking at that premium and super premium category. The premium and super premium category in the spirits industry is the fastest growing segment within the industry. And also, obviously, it's just the most likely to be counterfeit. So that's where we think we could provide the most benefit.
How much is premium? When you say premium, is that like over 1,000 is premium? Over super premium is?
No, I think, Dove, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think premium is over 250 and super premium is over 500.
Yeah, I would say even over 100 is already premium in the space. If you, again, I think it's undervalued, but even when you look at a bottle of, you know, Clase Azul tequila, which is, you know, the premium tequila in the space, is it started at $80. Now it's at around 150. They're going for, but you know, that's the opportunity. It's really on the higher end stuff. I think the whole world is starting to adapt this more and more. And as Sam said, this is the fastest growing segment in the industry. So people are just starting to, besides just collect more, they're just starting to drink better stuff and understand more about the brands that are being launched. You know, information is just out there now. So you understand how long it's aged, what type of cask, how the process is, you know, and all these different things that go into it. And it's really, there's a whole art that goes into, besides just aging, you know, you have a lot of, it just has to do with nature. You know, in the wine industry, you have a good year, you'll have a great vintage. You have a bad season, then that vintage won't be good. And you can't replicate nature. So you just, again, they're literally non-fungible, these great vintages that you can get. But they're just very difficult to, they're not liquid. You know, they're very difficult to trade and to move on, pass on to different
people. No pun intended.
Let me ask you this question. I've often wondered this. I want to make this first point and then I'll ask you a question. First is, I think you guys are doing, you haven't mentioned it explicitly, although maybe you've thought about it. It seems like we have a pervasive problem, at least in America, of abusing alcohol. Right. We had, the age is 21. People often drink. They'll go to parties in high school and they'll abuse it. They'll get way too drunk, myself included. Like Thanksgiving, like took vodka out of a friend's cabinet, drank way too much, had never had any before because it was off limits. And throughout college, drank way too much and way too much garbage because it was all about like the experience of being drunk at a party. That's what we're all after. And it felt, in hindsight, I'm 34 now, and it feels like, man, that's just not how I would ever want my son to interact with alcohol, because it is more like the way you describe it, Dov, is how, that's how I think of, that's the mature perspective, is like, okay, we're looking at the science of cultivating this really unique tasting, exciting spirit, and they call it spirit for a reason, like it makes you feel differently. But to get trashed and drink garbage vodka just seems like we have a lot of maturing to do. And I'll let you comment on that. But I want to ask you, how does the mainstream brands make such incredibly consistent products? Like, how does Bud Light and all these winemakers produce thousands and thousands of bottles all over the country in the world, and they all taste almost exactly the same? Are they somehow controlling nature in their production?
So on your first point, if you just look at the tequila industry, you know, as we were growing up, we're similar ages, we were probably drinking a lot of very cheap tequila shots, just getting wasted. Mm-hmm. And if you look where the tequila industry is today, you're looking at very premium sipping tequila, where, you know, people are really understanding the art of making, how it only comes from one region. And you're starting to see that the average price of tequila is just skyrocketing. And you'll see that in every different sector, where, you know, it used to be cheap whiskey and now it's more expensive whiskey. So it used to be cheap rum, now it's more expensive rum. So you're starting to see that in every category. And I think even the younger generation is starting to understand and appreciate what goes into this, you know, art of making wine and spirits. And then on your other point, yeah, I think it's just many years of perfecting their craft. If you look at, again, I'll go back to Johnnie Walker, they're putting many blends from different houses into one bottle to make that consistent. Usually they already start understanding how barrels age and how they get into, you know, what those will taste like over a certain period of time. So they already started perfecting that. But yeah, it's incredible what they can do. In the wine industry, it's harder to perfect that. It's hard, you know, every year is a different vintage, and
yeah,
be as consistent.
Is that just grapes mature just differently?
Grapes mature differently. You're having
the weather's different.
You'll have more rain one year. You can have a drought in California another year. You can have, you know, frozen grapes in in the French region another year. So it really depends on, really with wine, it's all about nature. I think on, when it comes to spirits, you can control a little bit more. You have, you're also at 40% alcohol. So the taste, you can kind of control a little bit better. But yeah, wine is really all about the vintage. And that, and that's why certain vintages just go for much more than others.
Yeah, also with wine and, you know, a bunch of different categories, it can only be considered in that category if it's from a specific region. So like Dov was saying, tequila has to be from Mexico, cognac has to be from cognac, champagne has to be from champagne, scotch from Scotland. You know, there's a bunch of these. But when you look at the wine category, it's like these vintages are coming from such a small patch of land that the weather plays a huge different role depending on, you know, where exactly your vineyard is. So it could be too cold that year, or it could be too hot that year, or it could be too moist that year. And it affects both the harvesting and then also the aging of the barrels. So I think that that makes it a little bit more difficult to pinpoint it. And when you look at some of these sommeliers, usually when they taste it, and Dov, correct me if I'm wrong again, because this is more your neck of the woods, but they could tell you the region it's from just based off of the taste. And then they could probably tell you the year it's from just because they've mastered what the different years from different regions taste like.
Wild. Wild.
Crazy.
Yeah. And by contrast, that's not the case with whiskey or other spirits because they use different, what does whiskey use? Barley? Or is that?
Yeah. So whiskey's using barley, and they'll ferment that, and then that'll go through the process of going through stills and then going into barrels. Again, if even the same, what's in that barrel every year will taste differently. So what it takes the malt master or, you know, whoever's deciding, or the whiskey maker, when to pull these out, they're tasting these all the time. They're smelling these and deciding when it's perfect maturity. And it's always different in different barrels because a lot of these barrels were previously wine barrels or bourbon barrels. So they really have to figure out, you know, when that is and then how much you're going to get from that, because, you know, as it ages, there's more, it evaporates more. So again, there's a whole art that goes into this that I think most of us don't appreciate. And then again, the few that do understand how to collect it and how to do it. But I think that's changing. I think the whole world of understanding, and, you know, there's a lot of tourism today around Napa Valley and around wineries and around distilleries. So there's a lot more, there's a lot more engagement, a lot more people understanding about it. But obviously there's a lot of education to be done. But again, I think we're just at the tip of the iceberg of how valuable these can be. As people start noticing, you know, higher age and different tastes, different aromas from different areas. And I was just at the Macallan Distillery, and how, you know, we tasted a 60-year-old bottle, and how different that is from, you know, a 12-year-old, and how different that is from a 21-year-old. And a lot of times it's not about age, it's about taste, you know, and you really can't say what's better and what's worse. It's really about taste. So it's, you know, again, I hope everybody gets an opportunity to go to distilleries, start tasting different products. It really opens the world up to, you know, different aromas that you just wouldn't get from just sipping, you know, just from drinking the shots that we drank as we were kids.
Yeah. Yeah. I went to in Puerto Rico, what's the rum maker down there? It's on the tip of my tongue. Who's the big trivia question? The big rum maker in Puerto Rico. It starts with a B. I forget the name. God, it's gonna kill me if I can't remember that. But they had they would give out tickets. It'll come to me. They give out tickets. Everyone gets like one ticket for the sampling. And I was, I think, 19 years old, and I got a ticket, so I got a little sample. But then the older people in the crowd that were on the same tour with us also got tickets, but they didn't want the samples, so they would give it to me. And I would just have like 7 tickets, and we would just sit around and have way too many. But it was such a cool experience to see behind the scenes how it's being made. And yeah, I do think these brands have a lot more to offer people because the experience and the story is like, that's the interesting part of it. It's like, it's not about just drinking cheap stuff to get drunk. It's like participating in the story, understanding it. There's a friend of mine who's a coach in the NBA. He's a strength coach. And apparently in the NBA, the players are all winos. They all collect wine. They talk about wine. They know wine. And I would have never guessed that. I just I don't know. It seems like it's more of an older crowd, but
yeah,
I guess that's the stereotype. It's not true.
Yeah. But also what you just said is a great point too. And you just keep making great points, but a lot of times when you do buy a product, you don't really know much about that product, meaning you just see that product on the shelf. You don't know the history of, you know, that specific distillery. You don't know the history of that specific vintage, which is something that we try to add to our website. We work a lot with the brands to make sure that it's customizable to them. So, you know, when you go on our website, it's not just, you know, rum, whiskey, wine, this one, that one. Each brand, because we're selective with the brands that we work with, each brand has their own brand page where it'll tell you the history, it'll tell you the current winemaker or master distiller. And then each product has its entire own drop page where it's going to tell you specifically why that product is special, the tasting notes, the ABV, a bunch of different details that maybe get overlooked. I'm sure you could figure it out if you see the product and you look it up online, but certain details and certain aspects that get overlooked. And again, it happens just because the product touches so many different hands before it ends up, you know, within a consumer. So, you know, just communicating that is a big aspect of what we do on our side also.
Love that. And so Dov, are you traveling around to different distilleries and makers trying to convince them that NFTs and this platform is something they should invest in? And by the way, it was Bacardi. Yeah. That was the name. Just came to me.
I knew Bacardi was from Puerto Rico. I thought it was more of like a boutique rum that you were talking about.
I travel. I mean, I think luckily from our fathers that have established these relationships for so many years. We do have well-established relationships with the brands where they trust us, where they, you know, they've been trusting us really to take them into this world. For them, it's a new world. You know, they're not used to it. But definitely that relationship from the duty-free world has helped us a lot. Now, obviously, we're traveling and speaking to them, and they're really grasping this and understanding it very well. As you said, it's, you know, it's almost like a no-brainer. But yes, traveling all the time. I guess I get to do the cool part of the business. Sam has to take care of the tech part and all that stuff. But yes, we speak to them all the time. And I think what's been very encouraging is how engaging the brands have been and how much they really didn't know about their customers, that they do want to learn about them. And they do want to learn about what the different trends are and what their customers care about, whether, you know, it's age, it's, you know, there's just so much that, you know, that the younger generation is caring about today that the brands really want to interact with. And I think one of the other points that we haven't mentioned is we launched a gifting aspect of our business. So when wine and spirits are huge in gifting, you know, end of the year or whatever it is, champagne, people are gifting different bottles to different people. I don't know if you've gone through the hassle of trying to figure out where that person lives, when they'll be home, because they have to, you know, make sure that you have to check their ID when they're home. Logistically, it's difficult to gift this type of stuff. So what we did is we launched a gifting product on our platform where you can simply, you know, once you buy the NFT, you could just send a gift to someone else. So I can buy something and say, you know, I know your email, so I'll send you your email, Mike. And I say, Mike, you know, here's a gift for me to you. I just bought this bottle. This is for you. Now that's automatic right away. That's, you just go on, you receive that email, you go online, you accept that gift, and that's automatically transferred on the blockchain to your digital wallet. So we just went through the whole hassle of the gifting process very seamlessly, and now it's in your digital wallet. And now you have the three options as well. You can redeem, you can put it up for sale, or you could just keep collecting it in your digital bar. So I think the whole gifting world, because, you know, NFTs have been hot with gifting as well now. I think in last holiday season. So, and I think we're just going to see more of that, where gifting NFTs is strong. I think gifting wine and spirits has been very strong, and that trend will start to continue.
Totally, totally. And Sam, on the tech side, I'm curious, what did you use? What existing tools out there did you spin up? I know there's a lot of things out there now. Is there a platform that you built this on to mint NFTs, or other tools that you've used to facilitate fiat transactions?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't build the website myself. I wish I was that talented, and I wish I could take credit for it. But no, I mean, I spent an embarrassing amount of time doing research, you know, and that's one of the cool things about this industry. And one of the cool things about modern technology, it's just, you know, Twitter, YouTube, and Reddit are just some of the best learning tools that anyone can come up with. But I just spent, you know, countless hours, countless days, almost months trying to really tap into this world, network a little bit to find the right people. And it's a little bit cliche because everybody says, you know, the first few employees that you hire are the most important. But I think we've proven that to be true, where we were really fortunate enough to find excellent developers, excellent designers, amazing account managers, marketing officers. So we just surrounded ourselves with an all-star team. Really, they make us look good.
What'd you do there? Did you hire a development firm to start off, or was a friend of yours that you hired?
Well, actually, the way I initially started when I was just getting into this world is I just went on OpenSea, Foundation App, and SuperRare, and I started messaging artists, basically saying, you know, I'm trying to learn about the space. I have a project that you might be interested in with X, Y, and Z company. So I have so many mocks of, you know, fragrances, dresses, liquor bottles. That was kind of how I started. And then through there, I would kind of ask them, you know, do you know anyone in the development world? Do you know anyone who, you know, works for some of these companies? And then even then I got the names of a few different developers. We assigned each one of them different projects, saw which one was best, and then just kept rolling with it like that. Eventually we built the entire team in-house. So we don't use a development firm or agency. We hired people in-house.
Awesome, man. Yeah, I love the design. It's just pretty, I mean, it's important when you're selling, you know, things that people don't need. They're collecting them for fun. They're trying to maybe make money, then cash them in one day. How is the model structured? Are you taking a transaction fee on new bottles minted, or is there some other
model? Yeah, so on the primary sale, when it's going first from the brand to a consumer, first of all, we have three release mechanics. You could either go through a lottery mechanism, which we usually recommend if it's one or two bottles. You could go through a first come, first served, or you could go through an auction. The way it works is we just take a regular retailer's margin. So in the industry, there's just kind of a standard take that a retailer would make. We operate under the same margin.
What's that, 40%?
And then what's cool 30%? About this, yeah, it's like between 30 and 40%, depends on the brand. And then what's cool about this is on every secondary sale, we store and insure the bottle for free for all of the consumers. But then on every secondary sale, we take a 10% commission and we split that directly with the brands. So the brand is now also incentivized to, you know, maintain the brand image, of course. But also we pitch ourselves as the most lucrative channel for a brand to sell their product. Just because number one, they don't have to go through multiple different intermediaries. They don't have to go through distributors, retailers, wholesalers. It's just one party. But then also they get the ability to, you know, get a percentage off of the appreciation in perpetuity of some of their bottles that are changing hands.
When they sell a line, like they sell 100 bottles, are they say all of them sell out in a minute, are they shipping those bottles to a warehouse that Blockbar would run, or do they just keep them in their space? Yeah.
So it depends. Like for example, we sold a barrel of wine, where it actually, it's a cool story, but they bought a barrel of wine, a group of like 20 people. There were a WhatsApp wine tasting group chat down in Miami. And basically that bottle of wine is still aging. So in 1 year, that barrel will be converted into 300 bottles. And then, you know, they'll split the NFTs the way they want to, but because that barrel is still aging, that barrel is still sitting, in the vineyard's facility. So in that case, it stays, you know, with the brand. But some of the other products that are already ready, they ship it to our warehouse. We have a warehouse in Singapore and we're opening up a few other locations. So they ship it to our bonded warehouse, which I should send you a video of the warehouse because it looks like a Bond movie where someone would store their stuff.
Oh, bonded. Is that what you meant by that? Singapore. Ship it to all the way over there? It seems like a...
Well, bonded means duty and tax free. So basically when the product is sitting there and it sells to somebody else, there's no sales tax. But part of the reason we put it in Singapore was just because that's probably the safest jurisdiction in the world. And insurers could tell you that too. And again, we're storing, you know, premium products for consumers around the world. We wanted to make sure that, you know, that product is as secure as possible. So, you know, there's motion sensors, temperature control, 24/7 guards, you know, basically sharks.
Got it.
That works.
Damn. All right. So you got this, you got the building that's sitting over there with all these bottles. You sell, they, McAllen launches 200 bottles. They sell out in a minute. You ship all the bottles to Singapore. Those are under lockdown until somebody redeems the bottle. Well,
usually we have the product in our facility before we release it, just to make sure that the numbers match and nothing gets, you know, destroyed along the way. But then some of the products that we sell aren't necessarily ready yet, in which case we put an earliest redemption date. So for example, that wine barrel, you can't redeem any of the bottles because the barrel hasn't been bottled yet and it's not in our facility. So we basically say, you own this, but you can't redeem it until December 1st.
Sweet, man. It's a slick setup. I dig it. I dig it. It kind of reminds me, there's a, this is a funny side story, but there's a story of the, in ancient times, the different empires across the land wanted to trade amongst each other. They had different currencies. So they all got together and said, hey, we're going to make a standard currency of gold. And we're going to all keep repositories in this island. And the island's going to have guards. It's going to be very, very safe. And if you make a transaction from one empire to the other, we'll just write down the transaction. And instead of moving gold from your empire to ours, it's all in one giant safe. And we're just going to make a note of it on the ledger. Well, one day, years later, one of the kings came to the island with his kids. And he said, hey, I want to see this island, see where all the gold is stored. And they go down to the cellar and they're like, oh, the kids want to go and see the gold. And the guy's like, no, we can't go down there. The doors are locked and it's really, really hassled. They're like, no, we came all this way. We want to see it. So he said, well, sir, a couple of years ago, there was an earthquake and all the gold sunk beneath the earth. And it's all gone, but don't worry. All the books are still in order. We haven't lost anything.
So we saw that. We actually have a live feed that's going to go live within the next month or so, where you can see the product there.
That's so smart.
So we want to make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah. Also, at least we have insurance. But you see, that's one of the benefits of. Of crypto with Bitcoin and Ethereum, no earthquake is going to swallow up your currency.
Yeah. That's so funny. Guys, this has been awesome. Do you want to give a shout out as to, are you guys on social media? Are you writing personally? And then we can talk about blockbar.com. Is that the domain? Yeah.
Yeah, blockbar.com. I mean, I think it's much more interesting to follow the Blockbar social media channels. Dove and I are not that interesting. We're just trying to work, but Blockbar does have a newsletter. It does have a blog. Twitter handle is BlockbarNFT. The Instagram handle is blockbar.eth. We try to educate our consumers. We put a lot of educational videos on YouTube. Some of the videos are actually awesome. We have our video editor is actually, I don't know if she's 16 or 17 years old, but she's amazing. I mean, it's crazy how talented she is, but so I urge everyone to check it out. And then if anyone wants to get in contact with us, we're on all the regular channels, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, of course. So always open to connect.
And are you guys raising or have you raised money already for the company?
No. So we've actually bootstrapped the whole company. We haven't taken any outside funding or any outside capital yet.
Nice. Any plans to, or do you think you'll just steamroll with the bootstrap?
I think we'll steamroll with the bootstrap. I think sometime soon we'll probably raise from strategics. People in the industry or brands in the industry, just someone that where the interests are aligned. Again, I'm not saying anything negative about VCs, but for us, we're providing a very particular service to the brands and to consumers. We don't want to mix in another party whose interest isn't necessarily aligned. So we would bring in, outside capital if it was the right partner and the right interest aligned.
Yeah, I think that's smart. You guys should go and say, hey, we're raising $10 million. And go to all the brands and say, hey, you can invest up to $500K just to give each one of them a slot, a ticket, an ownership. That way you sink in the distribution model. Like no one else comes in the space. Yeah. Is anyone else even doing this? Are there other companies with any efforts?
There's a few other companies that have started doing it. Again, the major difference maker for us at least is that we only work directly with the brands. So there was another company that launched, a barrel, but that barrel was sold from a private collector. And then the new person who bought it actually is not allowed to bottle it under the original brand, just because that brand is saying, it didn't come from us. You can't use our IP for it. So the big difference maker for us is that we only work directly with the brands. All the products on our website are done in partnership with the brands. We try to get the brands to mention it on social media. Again, of course, to build up the hype, but also just to give assurances to some of the consumers that are buying it that it does come directly from the brands. But that idea from raising from the brands is a good one. We should just go around to all the brands and say, you know, you guys should get some skin in the game. You know, not cannibalize anyone. Hopefully, you know, everyone can put their egos to the side and just view this as kind of like a syndicate for everybody to grow and
cap their investment. Pro tip, cap their invest so they can only invest like up to 200K or 300K each. That way, no one could come in and be like, I want to own 60% of the round.
It's a big dog. Then that
would probably disincentivize other brands to get really involved.
Right.
But yeah, just a thought. I don't know what I'm talking about. Guys, awesome. I love this. I love this company. throwing stuff out at you guys. If I can ever be helpful, reach out. Otherwise, blackbar.com is the site. And hope you guys keep kicking ass. It's an exciting project.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having us.
Great.
See you guys.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to Around the Coin. If you enjoyed the show today, consider giving us a quick review wherever you listen to podcasts. Tweet about it or text it to a friend. We really appreciate all the support and growing that we can. If you have any guests you'd like us to bring on or feedback for us, don't hesitate to reach out. We would love to hear from you.
This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.